Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Gabriella Coleman. I'm a professor of anthropology.
and wonderful to have you here. Many, many thanks. It's greatly appreciated. And I'd like to start, as I customarily do, by asking you about what the things are that currently dynamize, preoccupy, interest you.
Sure, maybe I'll give an example just from this morning. So, as many people here probably know, Elon Musk bought Twitter, renamed it X, and he's really using it as a platform to spread very concerning ideas. So today he retweeted something from Tucker Carlson, who used to be part of Fox News. And basically, Tucker Carlson tweeted, "There is systemic racism in the United States against whites. Everyone knows it. Nobody says it. How come?" And then Elon Musk's quote tweets it, "Concerning." And yeah, this is also concerning for me, just because he has such a large platform. And, the culture wars are really raging in Latin America, in Europe, in the United States, in Canada. And this is an issue that personally preoccupies me, and I'm also doing kind of some work around this as well.
And this is very reminiscent, Prof, of 50 years ago and the hysterical white male reaction to the Great Society reforms. And I'll apologize to the Prof and listeners. Allergy season for me began about 2 minutes ago, and I'm really struggling here. She's already seen me almost fall off my chair, sneezing and coughing, and now streaming, but not in a Netflix sense. So I'm sorry, Prof, and I hope this won't be too disturbing for you.
No, not at all. Not at
Okay.
all.
So, about this issue, it seems as though there is a white male hysteria that gets enormous tread whenever it bursts out. And it bursts out sometimes because of public policy initiatives, sometimes because of controversies, sometimes because of beat up stories and so on, and sometimes because of wealthy, juvenile, cunning but stupid people like Musk. And I'm interested in what's happened to X or Twitter as an authoritative source of something. And I wonder if you could map out for us what you think it was, is, and perhaps will be.
Sure, this is a great question, especially at this moment too, when there's these encampments across North America, growing in Europe, that are calling for a ceasefire in Israel or divestment, in investing in kind of Israeli firms. And I will say that whether it's past or present, I'm not so sure about the future, that I still think it's an important medium and platform. Even though Musk's ownership concerns me, and in some ways, whether he's an owner or not, even if he weren't an owner, he would still have a tremendous following, right?
Yeah.
But I still think about the fact that I do think that the politics around Israel and Palestine have changed in a more favorable way, where the plight of Palestinians have been showcased outside of the establishment media because of sites like Twitter or indie media in the past. And while I think portraying them as some sort of like panacea that will automatically usher in a more democratic state is pretty ridiculous. I would never want to go back to a state where we were just relying on the New York Times for our reporting, right? And even again with Musk, who is now the owner, and certainly the algorithms have been kind of configured in such a way, perhaps to showcase some content over other content, it's a battleground, you know. And even, let's just say, pro Palestinian, anti Netanyahu perspectives are very visible among certain populations, right? And so I still think of it as an important place. Now, one thing I will say though is a lot of people have left. I actually left for a while. I find it really hard to know that I'm supporting Musk in any way. And it's also the case that people are on Mastodon and Blue Sky. So, you know, eyeballs are kind of fragmented. But nevertheless, what do you do in these moments where police are beating students and arresting professors? Yes, that is getting some coverage, right? But it is really important to showcase this stuff. So I'm kind of ambivalent about it, you know. It's not that I want to celebrate it in any sort of naive way, but I actually do think that the politics of Palestine have changed because of sites like that and not because of like the New York Times. So where it's going to go, it's really hard to say, right? You know, a lot of people have left. There's some competing sites. At some point, it may be the case that everyone jumps ships to something like Blue Sky, or we may have, I think what we'll have is a few years of like transitional fragmentation where people are on multiple sites, like they were before, but there was a period where it's like almost everyone that wanted to have a presence on a site like Twitter was there, you know, journalists, academics, activists, and so on.
And my concern about this service goes back 8 years. It seems to me that whereas, and correct me if I've got this all wrong, in 2008 and 2012, the Obama people, the Democrats, and not only because of Obama, but previous campaigns, had a head start on so-called social media over the Republicans. Yeah, you're nodding, so it looks like I got that bit right.
Absolutely. That's right.
In 2016, I was appalled at the craven way in which the New York Times and the Washington Post, as the two most important sites of journalistic coverage and opinion politically in the United States, would cover not just on Twitter, but everywhere, whatever Donald J. Trump said on Twitter. And the same with CNN and CNBC and MSNBC and so on, that they built up Twitter, they built up Trump, they took these pronouncements as significant. Why didn't they just ignore them and treat him the same way they treated Hillary Clinton, which was, here's a speech, this is what it said, here's a policy document, this is what it lays out.
Yeah, no, they got baited, you know, and they couldn't kind of help themselves, and it was problematic. Although what's interesting too is I wish actually journalists, because it, you know, this was prior to the election actually. They were covering him, but they were also focusing in on, yeah, how kind of from a liberal perspective, you know, with his just extreme performativity and his willingness to kind of stick a finger to political correctness, right? Everyone was like shocked and basically saying like, oh, he's never going to be able to win, no way. But they were not, what they were not covering, I mean, what was interesting was that they weren't covering his rallies, for example, in stadiums, right? Where there was enormous support. And I think that would have actually been helpful to sort of rally people to be like, wow, no, he's a threat. And I will never forget actually watching his first debate. And I was like, oh my God, he so has a chance, you know, just because he is entertaining, right? And you know, and here I'll maybe draw a little bit on Nancy Fraser's 2019 book, where, you know, she rightly indicts neoliberal progressivism, where Yes, I prefer the Democrats to the Republicans, but they have basically they have their politics ha has not benefited the working class. They've made too many concessions to capital. And that's also part of the story here, right? I mean, I think
Yes.
it's very easy just to like point to Trump and be horrified by him and point to him as a problem. And he is, but it's also built on a foundation of very weak politics in the Democratic Party, where they kind of embrace neoliberalism and then are supposedly progressive because of their identity politics, right? Anyways, so journalists, I think, were very problematic for overlooking how popular he actually was in face arenas. And then, once he gets elected, basically just cannot stop but give him endless coverage based on his tweets, right? So there was just a lot of missteps
Yes.
prior to him being elected and after being elected as well.
And he was right in that campaign and later to say to African American voters, the Democratic Party takes you for granted and gives you nothing. It's really
That's it.
true.
It's so true. And exactly, like if I had any willingness to sort of be like the Joker and just be like, all right, let's let things burn or whatever, right? I can understand. I can actually understand why some people went there, that there's a kind of deep dissatisfaction with the status quo. And I share that. And back to sort of talking about establishment journalists, when Bernie Sanders was on the ticket, he actually was quite popular, in ways that I even found surprising. And the New York Times, Washington Post types were just denigrating him, and
All
then
the
it was
time.
all the time. And then it was like Salon and the smaller outlets that were just giving him fair or serious coverage. Imagine had the Washington Post and the New York Times actually just done that as well. I mean, we know that it's not simply about what you report on, but how often you do it, the framing, right? And so, of course, they ideologically are not aligned with a kind of Bernie figure. But they certainly threw up barriers as well, right? And it still would have been a tough win for him. Like it would have been tough for him to win. But nevertheless, I think, a lot of sort of liberals were just so naive around everything from how much of the voter base had been overlooked to why Trump would be popular under those conditions.
And I guess the other factor, which I was talking about this morning with an economist for an earlier episode, is that 40% of people are going to vote for the Republican Party, even if they put up a dog or a cat as the candidate. And the same with the Democratic Party. We're
Right,
only
that's
talking
right.
about,
That's true.
a minority, but a sizable one that changes its vote or votes sometimes, but not always. And, they're the ones that are being targeted. Now, some of the statistics I've seen suggest that in the upcoming presidential campaign, the vast majority of advertising money will still go to broadcast television because that's
Right.
what poor people watch. And
Right.
there's a struggle over the Latino vote, which is splitting more than before. And for lots of poor Latinos and Latinas, it's Univision and Telemundo, and it's not even cable, right? But the other thing that seems to be coming to light, and again, please correct me if I've got this wrong, is that in terms of young people and political information, it's not X. They're not interested. They're not on it. It's not Facebook. It's things like discussion groups, not old-fashioned discussion groups, but phone application groups like WhatsApp, where we're almost going back to a model of political communication from 70 years ago, where personal discussion, family leaders, religious leaders, people in your circle, my circle, our circles, plant information or share information about politics, which we pick up and distribute. But that's where this stuff is going on right now in the US for the first time, much more than it was in the past. So it's Instagram, to a certain extent, TikTok, but especially places like WhatsApp and Telegram. Do you think that's right? And if so, what does that tendency say to you?
I mean, yeah, my understanding is that young people are, for those that are engaged in discussing politics, are on group chats and TikTok, Instagram, right? And then, some portion are in other places, like the image boards. If you're kind of in more reactionary circles, right? And I mean, it's, I think, a little bit hard to get a sense of what the repercussions of this might be. It is certainly the case that, there's a portion, I think, of young people who are not politically involved. But given the conditions of the world and what people are facing, that I think has kind of compelled people to act politically, right? But I think what concerns me at this very particular juncture, outside of the means of communication, is the political predicament where, there's going to be a portion of people who are definitely not going to vote for Trump, but I'm not sure they're going to vote for Biden either. I
Arab
mean,
Americans in Michigan, for
oh, say
example.
that again.
Arab Americans in Michigan.
Exactly. And right now, after these protests and the police crackdown, where Biden is like, there's raging anti-Semitism on campus, there is some. For sure. But the great majority of protesters are wanting kind of a ceasefire for Palestine. That's a different issue. And so if you gaslight people who would be your supporters, I mean, I'm very pessimistic. I'm very, and the only thing that actually might just potentially save Biden, weirdly enough, is just the extreme laws around abortion in the United States. Right. So Arizona just passed a law that's from like the 1800s, basically, And so, maybe on voting days, people just be like, I don't want to vote for him, but it is the lesser of two evils or something. Otherwise, I do think we're in a situation where, Trump is appealing to, yeah, that 40% he's going to get. I think, as you noted, a lot of Latinos, a lot of people who are not seeing, it's not that even they're seeing economic benefit. It's just that it is extremely hard in the United States unless you're already a homeowner. Because if you're paying rent or having to buy, you're being shut out completely at this moment, right? Combine that with, gaslighting protesters, people really not seeing certain type of shifts around the economy. I almost, again, can't see Biden winning, except for maybe the threat of kind of abortion, motivating a lot of women to vote.
And of course, the other thing is related to this. On the one hand, people are seeing this as a return to 68 and the law and order vote going against Biden. But the Republican Party is no longer the party of law and order, if it ever was. It
Right.
cannot even claim rhetorically to be such because of the so-called deep state that is infesting law and order services. So it's interesting to see how well or ill that argument will play. In any event, Prof, this is great stuff, but I really want to get at your research. And for people to learn a bit more about it, it's multifaceted. It relates to some of the things we're discussing here. But one of the core issues that you've been looking at for many years and understand well is hacking. Can you explain? I know this sounds obvious, what it is.
Computer hacking is a set of kind of activities often tied to groups of people who identify as kind of computer hackers. and tend to be really kind of obsessive around computing. But this sort of general orientation towards computers and hacking then refracts into different genres of hacking, from kind of free and open source to security to hacktivism, where there's quite distinct kind of practices and ethics and politics that get attached to hacking. And also, another dimension, along with sort of variable, you might want to say kind of technical orientations. There's also big regional differences as well. So the hackers of Silicon Valley are going to be very different from the hackers of, Spain, for example, where Spanish hackers tend to have a left progressive orientation. In Silicon Valley, it's all about capitalistic disruption. And so my work has focused a lot on, originally free and open source software, hacktivism as well as kind of other domains of computer hacking.
And have you discerned a transformation in hacking over this period in his regional terms, political terms, etc.? You've already described brilliantly for us, in summary, some of the issues that have become more and less relevant, security, for instance. But I wonder if you could sketch out for us what seems to have changed.
Well, maybe I'll talk about what has changed around hacktivism, just because, my last big book was on Anonymous, which had been very, very in 2010 and 14, and then kind of waned with some small forms of. There have been some kind of resurgences in 2020, for example, or Ukraine and Russia. And one thing I like to remind my kind of readers or viewers or listeners is that one of the things that Anonymous helped put on the table and cement was the hack. So where you hack into an organization, get data, documents, emails, and leak it, especially for journalists, so that they will mine it and use it for reporting. Now, what I am working on right now is a history of the hack and leak. And what I love about it is that it was not a very obvious modality to hackers, even those breaking into systems, even those that were politically minded. It really just took a lot of experimentation in order for hackers to put the hack and leak together. And then during the Anonymous era, where there was a lot of experimentation with this modality, and it was very visible, it served as the basis for like copycatting. And then other groups started to use it, including nation states. But today, there's some hacktivist groups like Phineas Fisher or Guacamaya from Latin America that really were inspired by Anonymous. And they've been very, very successful in their hacking and leaking. But they're not as visible. But that's also because that's a mechanism to protect themselves. A lot of the Anonymous hackers who were experimenting with this were doing it prolifically. They were also interfacing with the public all the time, and that put them at risk. And in fact, many got arrested. But those that have come in their footsteps are a little bit quieter. They're not making as much noise. They're not as present, but they're far more effective. And so, in some ways, I would say that hacktivism is just as important, and in some ways more effective, precisely because the hacktivists are not getting arrested. And
Now,
I can
Prof,
give an example.
you haven't mentioned the W word, WikiLeaks.
I could do that
Well, could you juxtapose for us Anonymous and WikiLeaks?
mean, they couldn't be more different at some level. For WikiLeaks was this very small, tightly controlled organization that really associated and identified with a single figure, Julian Assange, who is currently sitting in jail in the UK, and did fall out of favor with a lot of leftists and progressives for good reasons, although I think it's also important to support the fight against his extradition. And Anonymous was this wily, wild, multiple use name, a true social movement that was predicated on the idea of anonymity, where they didn't want a figure or leader like Julian Assange. And so their kind of social architecture could not be more different. But they are connected insofar as, you know, it's kind of a domain where geeks and hackers took action politically and did change kind of politics and geopolitics. And there were moments too that Anonymous really supported WikiLeaks, or for example, there were some anonymous hacktivists like Jeremy Hammond who, you know, hacked organizations like Stratfor, a global intelligence firm, took the emails, gave them to WikiLeaks, right? So there was a kind of symbiotic relationship there, even as they were quite distinct. And WikiLeaks, you know, as much as I'm critical of some aspects of what they did, of Julian Assange, I still think it was a very important, interesting experiment where we needed a fourth party or a fifth party, if we consider, you know, journalism the fourth estate, because in the United States especially, they were spineless, completely spineless. And, you know, I could give some examples, but they were not publishing the sorts of things that then WikiLeaks would publish. And now there's anonymous drop boxes, there's other projects like DDoS Secrets, which is a repository of many, many leaks. And I think WikiLeaks innovated in a way that engendered a lot of problems and mistakes with the project, but that the experiment was successful insofar as it created a new kind of paradigm of having a kind of independent party host these sorts of leaks that, you know, are not necessarily gonna just in some simplistic way lead to social change, but I would prefer to have a site for leaks than not have them as well.
And of course, he built a career attacking journalism, Assange, even as A, he relied entirely on it to get known and for the leaks to become really public. And B, he now claims he's a journalist, and his defenders argue that he merits protection on that basis. So there is a very interesting relationship between the idea of being entirely different from bourgeois journalism and the bourgeois media, and relying on them in the same way as Trump, refers to CNN, the New York Times, and the Post as fake news, but he would be nowhere without them. So there is something fascinating there about the sticky indexicality and power of journalism, it seems.
Absolutely. And you can't replace it fully, but you could push against it as WikiLeaks did. But then you also need their validation at some level, right? And so, had the New York Times or The Guardian or El País or Le Monde never, if they never reported on the cables that were released by WikiLeaks, the diplomatic American cables, or Collateral Murder, which was the video of the US Army gunning down and killing journalists, which again, Reuters, who had been affected, it was Reuters journalists, they saw the video. They knew about the video, but they would not report on it. I mean, that's a problem, right? That's a problem. So, yes, WikiLeaks and the sort of hacker domain that hosts leaks, takes leaks, is still reliant on journalists. But in existing, they force journalism to change as well, right? But you're not going to get rid of sort of institutions like the New York Times at least not easily, right? Like once you have buildings and a famous kind of history and legacy and people want to work there, right? You're not going to probably destroy them, but you can change them. And I do think that the WikiLeaks intervention was a really important one at the time.
And Prof, what about hacking becoming institutionalized within the state? This is something that you've looked at and is extremely important. I wonder if you could explain that to us, because many of us may think of hacking as something either utterly criminal or utterly romantic, or a bit of both. But it's actually a banal part of institutional life, isn't it? Also, as well as being those other things.
Absolutely. It's all those things, right? And part of my new book of essays, and then also some work that I published out of Data and Society with Matthew Gorzin, looked at how former non-malicious black hat hackers, so they were illegally breaking into systems, basically, and they were doing it mostly for status and fun and intellectual edification, not necessarily for even politics, or some people who are kind of political in the mix, especially in Europe, but generally kind of apolitical. But at some point, they're like, we have really good security skills, and the state of security on the internet or for corporations and even for some governments was kind of lacking. So these black hat hackers kind of left the shadows and said, you should take us seriously as experts. And there was a big debate. Some people were like, do not touch these people. They're criminal. Would you hire an arsonist to be a firefighter? And then others were like, well, actually, I
Actually,
do think.
quite a lot of firefighters are arsonists,
Yeah,
isn't it?
exactly. And anyways, these hackers did in some ways win the battle, and they became leading kind of experts in the security industry in both kind of corporate and governmental realms, and helped shape the industry as well. And in different places, there's different trajectories. So for example, in France, there was one intelligence organization who wanted to recruit hackers. To break into kind of systems to kind of, find terrorists. And so basically they infiltrated the underground. And if you were arrested, young hacker, they went to you and said, well, if you want to kind of evade jail, why don't you work for us? Right. And so they got enrolled that way. A different intelligence organization in France was just like, you're crazy. And they just retrained their cryptographers. So there's definitely been these movements that have come from within hacking or from top down from the government to recruit hackers for their skills. And many hackers, not all, but many are also very much part of the kind of security apparatus as well. And so, yeah, indeed, there's many different types of politics that come with hacking, right? And I tried to kind of understand things sort of historically and anthropologically, and try to get away from that binary of either sort of like pure freedom fighters or, working for the man, although those two exist. Those exist, and so do things in the middle as well.
And Prof, you've mentioned being an anthropologist and operating ethnographically, not wanting to trespass on complex matters of privacy and so on. How do you do an ethnography of anonymous? How do you do an ethnography of people whose stock in trade is to be secretive? So I'm not
Well,
looking for your secrets. I just want to know what you publicly avow. Do you know what I mean?
yeah, no, for sure. And it also so with Anonymous, in some ways it was relatively easy to do research. I mean, it was not easy. It was I felt like I was often going crazy, and it was really exciting and frustrating and scary at times. But Anonymous between 2010 in 14, 15, when I was doing research, they were in chat rooms and they really courted attention. And so it was totally fine for me to be on the public chat rooms. And I also was what I call a broker and a gopher, where I actually got a lot of journalists to these chat rooms. And I was able to see a lot of the organizing and interview people, but I was not on the secret channels. And that was to protect me and them, just because I could have gotten into huge, huge, huge legal trouble if I was in the rooms where they were organizing the hacking. But it was also the case that after people had gotten arrested, a number of people, for better or for worse, leaked some of these conversations and chats from the private rooms, which was super helpful because I had interviewed people and they had told me what had happened. And there were actually no one really lied to me, which was amazing. But it was much more interesting having the live chats. Way more chaotic. All the contingencies were there, right? But that was only possible because people got arrested. Had, for example, people leak that stuff to me when they were had not been arrested, I would have not used that data, right? And then, I referenced groups like Phineas Fisher and Guacamaya. I actually stay away from them. They're being effective, and I don't feel they're not courting attention. They don't have like public chat rooms like Anonymous did. So I don't want to put them at risk, if that makes sense. And so I'm hoping that maybe later on, after time passes, I can do work. And in fact, the security stuff I had talked about, it's a kind of what I call living history of the internet. It's not quite ethnography because it's in the past. But a lot of the people involved are alive. And so me and my collaborator used a lot of archival data and interviewed people, and people are willing to speak now, right? And so we're trying to get them while they're still alive. The statute of limitations have passed, right? So I think every situation is different, but with Anonymous, they really were open to having people around. I stayed away from the secret channels, and then once people got arrested, I was able to get different forms of access to people and data that then I was able to use.
This is wonderful. Thank you, Prof, for being so clear about that. It's really interesting and handy. And I think you've navigated that complex terrain very effectively, if I may say so. So, a question about, like, dude, what the fuck is digital ethnography? Is it going to be the fifth field of US anthropology?
That's a great question. I'm a little bit torn about the term digital ethnography, actually, even though I'm often identified as someone who is very much in this area. And the reason why is the digital now does pertain to so many different areas and arenas that it's almost like saying, like, I'm an anthropologist of the nation, which people are sometimes anthropologists of the nation. But even beyond that, like the digital can be about everything from, the constitution of nationhood to, being home to, microcultures that would not have existed outside of the digital, to so many things in between that I think it's too expansive of a domain to call itself digital ethnography. That is not to say that people who work on the digital, they should get together and there's a lot to kind of share and think through. But for example, doing research on image boards, which I've done research on these anonymous image boards, is completely different from studying influencers. I mean, they're like not related in any way, but the term digital ethnography puts them in the same bucket. Does that make sense? And that's a problem.
Oh,
So
absolutely. Yeah.
I think a lot about this, and one day I want to write some piece which is like against digital ethnography,
But I mean, one could also say that, for example, cultural anthropology includes political economics or political economy that's historical, as well as, drawings of kinship. relationships.
Yep, that's true. Like it's
So
contagious.
very
Cultural
different
anthropology.
things, right? And they can be functionalist, cultural anthropology, just as well as they can be Marxist or feminist or anti-colonial, right? So I just worry about people who go online and then write down or copy what they see, and that's research. And I'm not in any sense wishing to imply that that's you. Not for a second. But when I read that something is digital ethnography, I just want to know what it actually involved. I guess that's my
No.
anxiety, and perhaps it's your anxiety too, from what you're saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And because the digital can encompass so many different things, it's going to mean very different things
Yes.
around just the object of study and then your orientation as well, right? Are you bringing that kind of political economic lens to it, or are you coming at it more from like a micro interactional perspective, like Irving Goffman, right? In between. And I will say, I mean, I hope also this doesn't come off as arrogant or something, but I actually was frustrated by media studies approaches to digital ethnography because anthropology tends to be very, very sort of like deep and holistic at the same time, right? So that you would never do like 3 months of digital ethnography and call it ethnography, right? You have to go much, much, much deeper. And that might mean doing stuff offline. It doesn't necessarily mean that either, right? Or historically contextualizing it. There's a big, there's a historical sensibility in anthropology. And I feel like in media studies, unless you're a media historian, there's not. And my new book of essays is actually, among other things, trying to inject a historical sensibility into kind of media studies approaches to the digital. In fact, I also think that when you're studying the present online, I mean, this is anything that you study in the present, but I think it is particularly acute in some digital domains. It's like there's only so many things you can say, and you actually have to wait for the passage of time and return to the past. And that's what I'm doing in this book of essays too, is like I wrote this big book about Anonymous, and there were some analytical points, but actually not a whole lot. Part of it was because it was a popular genre, but part of it was like I don't know how things are going to shake out, you know? And now I'm able to say. So I'm going back, for example, the history of the hack and leak is a really, really kind of in-depth history about how this tactic came into being. There's no way I could have figured that out at the time. It was like too chaotic. I didn't even see it as an issue to look at. Anyway, so I think injecting a historical sensibility and digital studies is extremely important, even if it's a micro historical sensibility. And I agree that, laying out what you did and how you did it is very important. But then again, there's no unitary method around the digital because it depends on what you're looking at and the questions you're asking as well, which again is why I'm like, what is digital anthropology, right? It's,
I think some of what you're concerned about with reference to media studies is also a concern that much of anthropology has had with sociological ethnography.
Yeah.
Too quick, too dirty, too shallow. I'm using those terms,
Right.
you're not. And rightly or wrongly, they tend to stick. And sometimes these things can be about position taking and curating one's own discipline and so on. And sometimes they have really important points to make. And I think what you say about media studies is very true. And I think it's a wider point about presentism, actually.
Right,
It's not
that's
just
right.
about people who are not media historians, but people
That's
who don't take a wider perspective. I wanted to ask you, going back to one of the things that you touched on when we were talking about politics, and don't worry, I'm going to free you from the podcast in a moment, Prof. I wanted to ask about gender, race, class in hacking. Is this, white boys with nascent moustaches sitting in, the seedy rooms at the bottom of their parents' houses? Is it cynics trying to make money in Russia or Albania? What about feminist hackers? What about black hackers, etc.?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's lots of different answers depending on, are you looking at so-called criminal hacking out of Bulgaria versus like open source or security or hacktivism? And I will say, first of all, that it is way more complicated and interesting than what people might imagine, which is like a bunch of privileged white guys that have no sense of questions of, race and gender and these sorts of things. And partly because historically and still even currently, it's still very overwhelmingly male. And it's changed quite a bit, but I will try to complicate it in a few ways. So for example, in the world of free and open source software, a concern around kind of gender and race came way before academia. Let's just put it that way, and I find that interesting. So there were just all sorts of projects around this issue that started popping up. There were codes of conduct for conferences way before they popped up for, let's just say, academic ones, right? They were much more at the kind of forefront of this. And also, there was a kind of big Me Too movement in 2016 in the hacker world around Jacob Applebaum, who was kind of exposed as an abuser. And, without much thought, like most projects were like, yeah, we're banning him, once the information came out. And so there was a kind of openness to these sorts of politics that came, pretty early on. And that came from people from within pushing. I also think that this domain is one where people with disabilities and transgender people have been very visible and present since the beginning. And there's been a lot of gender changing as well. And so while there were, yeah, maybe not as many women initially, a lot of people would change gender and people were very accepting, right? And so there are kind of complicated dynamics around these issues, right, that often just get whitewashed when people sort of finger point, like they're just a bunch of white guys. I'm like, well, no, it's a lot more interesting and complicated, both in terms of its history and then just what people have done from within. And maybe one last thing to say about this is during the time period where hackers really started to care about this stuff, the reactionary right started to be very, very critical of these social justice interventions. And for the most part, the hacker world has not gone to that plank, but it is always a threat, if that makes sense, just because you do, and especially like in Silicon Valley right now, people like, Elon Musk or Mark Andreessen are super, super, super anti thinking about the politics of sort of, race and gender and want to, go back to a world where it's just pure meritocracy. Or if anything, again, Elon is like, well, it's really, there's racism against white people in this really dramatic way, right? So we're at a moment where there's a true battlefield over this, but generally the hacker world, even in places like security hacking, and then certainly more progressive, politically oriented areas of hacking have sort of intervened in these politics in more or less successful ways, right? So there's a lot more to say, but I just think that sort of simplistic story that there's just a bunch of white guys, and that they sort of embrace their whiteness and keep people out is actually not accurate at all.
And I wonder, Prof, if to conclude, there are things you'd like to add to what we've discussed. These might be things that are with reference to topics we've touched on, or entirely new things. What would you like to send your public away holding on to?
Yeah, great. I'm glad you asked that because I recently published a piece which was based on a lecture which compares big A anonymous to little A anonymous, the reactionary right to QAnon. They all came from the image boards, and many filmmakers and some journalists and a few sloppy academics make it seem like the anonymous reactionary right came from the ashes of Big A Anonymous. And that QAnon also very simplistically was related to the reactionary right. And I really question that story of a linear evolution and also really highlight many of the different tactics and politics of these groups. Like, the content matters, what they do matters. And I think we really need to look at their differences as much as their similarities. And the similarities are the ones that have been emphasized. And it's a complete sort of rewriting and mangling of history that is going on. And it's so interesting because when I presented some of my work on Anonymous, this anthropologist, Gary at CUNY, was like, the history of Anonymous is going to get mangled and rewritten because they are very confusing. And he pointed me to a great book by Christine Ross on 1968 and its afterlives. That's what the book's called. And it's about how sociologists and journalists sort of defanged the radical politics of 68. And similar processes are at work with Anonymous. And so some of my work is trying to kind of think about why those distortions are happening and also trying to kind of correct them. And also partly doing so because, the image boards that help produce Anonymous, the hacktivists, and the reactionary right also show that political paths, different political paths are possible. And I think too often people treat people as already constituted political subjects. And I think we do have to think about recruitment and transformation. And so part of my intervention differentiating these formations is a reminder of the need to think about recruitment and creating different political paths. So maybe, you could check it out. It's on my website. It's a lecture, which is the basis of an essay, when and if I ever get back to writing.
Thank you so much, Prof. Coleman. It's been terrific having the chance to learn more about your work. It's greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thanks for having me.